were deadly tired, as if they had walked all night under a burden, or had been swimming long against a heavy tide of water. At last they could go no further without a halt. Frodo stopped and sat down on a stone. They had now climbed up to the top of a great hump of bare rock. Ahead of them there was a bay in the valley side, and round the head of this the path went on, no more than a wide ledge with a chasm on the right. Across the sheer southward face of the mountain it crawled upwards, until it disappeared into the blackness above. "I must rest a while, Sam," whispered Frodo. "It's heavy on me, Sam, lad, very heavy. I wonder how far I can carry it. Anyway, I must rest before we venture on to that." He pointed to the narrow way ahead. "Shh, shh!" hissed Gollum, hurrying back to them. "Shh!" His fingers were on his lips, and he shook his head urgently. Tugging at Frodo's sleeve, he pointed towards the path. But Frodo would not move. "Not yet," he said. "Not yet." Weariness and more than weariness oppressed him. It seemed as if a heavy spell was laid on his mind and body. "I must rest," he muttered. At this Gollum's fear and agitation became so great that he spoke again, hissing behind his hand, as if to keep the sound from unseen listeners in the air.
"Not here, no. Not rest here, fools. Eyes can see us. When they come to the bridge, they will see us. Come away. Climb, climb, come."
"Come, Mr. Frodo," said Sam. "He's right again. We can't stay here."
"All right," said Frodo in a remote voice, as of one speaking half asleep. "I will try." Wearily he got to his feet. But it was too late. At that moment the rock quivered and trembled beneath them. The great rumbling noise, louder than ever before, rolled in the ground and echoed in the mountains. Then with searing suddenness there came a great red flash. Far beyond the eastern mountains it leapt into the sky and splashed the lowering clouds with crimson. In that valley of shadow and cold deathly light, it seemed unbearably violent and fierce. Peaks of stone and ridges like notched knives sprang out in staring black against the uprushing flame in Gorgoroth. Then came a great crack of thunder, and Minas Morgul answered. There was a flare of livid lightnings, forks of blue flame springing up from the tower and from the encircling hills into the sullen clouds. The earth groaned, and out of the city there came a cry, mingled with harsh high voices as of birds of prey, and the shrill neighing of horses wild with rage and fear, there came a rending screech, shivering, rising swiftly to a piercing pitch beyond the range of hearing. The hobbits wheeled round towards it, and cast themselves down, holding their hands upon their ears. As the terrible cry ended, falling back through a long, sickening wail to silence, Frodo slowly raised his head. Across the narrow valley, now almost on a level with his eyes, the walls of the evil city stood, and its cavernous gate, shaped like an open mouth with gleaming teeth, was gaping wide, and out of the gate an army came. All that host was clad in sable, dark as the night. Against the wan walls and the luminous pavement of the road, Frodo could see them, small black figures in rank upon rank, marching swiftly and silently, passing outwards in an endless stream. Before them went a great cavalry of horsemen, moving like ordered shadows, and at their head was one greater than all the rest, a rider, all black, save that on his hooded head he had a helm like a crown that flickered with a perilous light. Now he was drawing near the bridge below, and Frodo's staring eyes followed him, unable to wink or to withdraw. Surely there was the Lord of the Nine Riders returned to earth to lead his ghastly host to battle? Here, yes, here indeed was the haggard king whose cold hand had smitten down the ring-bearer with his deadly knife. The old wound throbbed with pain, and a great chill spread towards Frodo's heart. Even as these thoughts pierced him with dread and held him bound as with a spell, the rider halted suddenly, right before the entrance of the bridge, and behind him all the host stood still. There was a pause,
a dead silence.
Maybe it was the ring that called to the Wraith Lord, and for a moment he was troubled, sensing some other power within his valley. This way and that turned the dark head, helmed and crowned with fear, sweeping the shadows with its unseen eyes. Frodo waited, like a bird at the approach of a snake, unable to move. And as he waited, he felt, more urgent than ever before, the command that he should put on the ring. But great as the pressure was, he felt no inclination now to yield to it. He knew that the ring would only betray him, and that he had not, even if he put it on, the power to face the Morgul King. Not yet. There was no longer any answer to that command in his own will, dismayed by terror though it was, and he felt only the beating upon him of a great power from outside. It took his hand, and as Frodo watched with his mind, not willing it but in suspense, as if he looked on some old story far away, it moved the hand inch by inch towards the chain upon his neck. Then his own will stirred. Slowly it forced the hand back and set it to find another thing, a thing lying hidden near his breast. Cold and hard it seemed as his grip closed on it, the file of Galadriel, so long treasured and almost forgotten till that hour. As he touched it, for a while all thought of the ring was banished from his mind. He sighed and bent his head. At that moment the Wraith King turned and spurred his horse and rode across the bridge, and all his dark host followed him. Maybe the elven hoods defied his unseen eyes, and the mind of his small enemy, being strengthened, had turned aside his thought. But he was in haste. Already the hour had struck, and at his great master's bidding he must march with war into the west. Soon he had passed, like a shadow into shadow, down the winding road, and behind him still the black ranks crossed the bridge. So great an army had never issued from that vale since the days of Isildur's might. No host so fell and strong in arms had yet assailed the fords of Anduin, and yet it was but one, and not the greatest of the hosts, that Mordor now sent forth. Frodo stirred, and suddenly his heart went out to Faramir. "The storm has burst at last," he thought. "This great array of spears and swords is going to Osgiliath. Will Faramir get across in time?" He guessed it. But did he know the hour? And who can now hold the fords when the King of the Nine Riders comes, and other armies will come? "I'm too late. All is lost. I tarried on the way. All is lost. Even if my errand is performed, no one will ever know. There will be no one I can tell. It will be in vain." Overcome with weakness, he wept, and still the host of Morgul crossed the bridge. Then, at a great distance, as if it came out of memories of the Shire, some sunlit early morning, when the day called and doors were opening, he heard Sam's voice speaking. "Wake up, Mr. Frodo! Wake up!" had the voice added. "Your breakfast is ready." He would hardly have been surprised. Certainly Sam was urgent. "Wake up, Mr. Frodo! They're gone," he said. There was a dull clang. The gates of Minas Morgul had closed. The last rank of spears had vanished down the road. The tower still grinned across the valley, but the light was fading in it. The whole city was falling back into a dark brooding shade and silence. Yet still it was filled with watchfulness. "Wake up, Mr. Frodo! They're gone! And we'd better go, too. There's something still alive in that place, something with eyes, or a seeing mind, if you take me. And the longer we stay in one spot, the sooner it will get on to us. Come on, Mr. Frodo!" Frodo raised his head, and then stood up. Despair had not left him, but the weakness had passed. He even smiled grimly, feeling now as clearly as a moment before he had felt the opposite, that what he had to do, if he could, and that whether Faramir or Aragorn or Elrond or Galadriel or Gandalf or anyone else ever knew about it, was beside the purpose. He took his staff in one hand and the phial in his other. When he saw that the clear light was already welling through his fingers, he thrust it into his bosom and held it against his heart. Then, turning from the city of Morgul, now no more than a grey glimmer across a dark gulf, he prepared to take the upward road. Gollum, it seemed, had crawled off along the ledge into the darkness beyond, when the gates of Minas Morgul opened, leaving the hobbits where they lay. He now came creeping back, his teeth chattering and his fingers snapping.
"Foolish! Silly!" he hissed. "Make haste! They mustn't think danger has passed. It hasn't. Make haste!"
They didn't answer, but they followed him on to the climbing ledge. It was little to the liking of either of them, not even after facing so many other perils, but it didn't last long. Soon the path reached a rounded angle where the mountainside swelled out again, and there it suddenly entered a narrow opening in the rock. They'd come to the first stair that Gollum had spoken of. The darkness was almost complete, and they could see nothing much beyond their hand's stretch. But Gollum's eyes shone pale, several feet above, as he turned back towards them.
"Careful," he whispered. "Steps. Lots of steps. Must be careful."
Care was certainly needed. Frodo and Sam at first felt easier, having now a wall on either side, but the stairway was almost as steep as a ladder, and as they climbed up and up, they became more and more aware of the long black fall behind them. And the steps were narrow, spaced unevenly, and often treacherous. They were worn and smooth at the edges, and some were broken, and some cracked as foot was set upon them. The hobbits struggled on, until at last they were clinging with desperate fingers to the steps ahead, and forcing their aching knees to bend and straighten. And ever as the stair cut its way deeper into the sheer mountain, the rocky walls rose higher and higher above their heads. At length, just as they felt that they could endure no more, they saw Gollum's eyes peering down at them again.
"We're up," he whispered. "First stairs passed. Clever hobbits to climb so high. Very clever hobbits. Just a few more little steps, and that's all. Yes."
Dizzy and very tired, Sam, and Frodo following him, crawled up the last step and sat down rubbing their legs and knees. They were in a deep, dark passage that seemed still to go up before them, though at a gentler slope and without steps. Gollum did not let them rest long.
"There's another stair still," he said. "Much longer stair. Rest when we get to the top of next stair, not yet."
Sam groaned. "Longer, did you say?" he asked.
"Yes, yes, longer," said Gollum. "But not so difficult. Hobbits have climbed the straight stair. Next comes the winding stair."
"And what after that?" said Sam.
"We shall see," said Gollum softly. "Oh, yes, we shall see."
"I thought you said there was a tunnel," said Sam. "Isn't there a tunnel or something to go through?"
"Oh, yes, there's a tunnel," said Gollum. "But hobbits can rest before they try that. If they get through that, they'll be nearly at the top. Very nearly, if they get through. Oh, yes."
Frodo shivered. The climb had made him sweat, but now he felt cold and clammy, and there was a chill draught in the dark passage, blowing down from the invisible heights above. He got up and shook himself. "Well, let's go on," he said. "This is no place to sit in." The passage seemed to go on for miles, and always the chill air flowed over them, rising as they went on to a bitter wind. The mountains seemed to be trying with their deadly breath to daunt them, to turn them back from the secrets of the high places, or to blow them away into the darkness behind. They only knew that they had come to the end, when suddenly they felt no wall at their right hand. They could see very little. Great black shapeless masses and deep grey shadows loomed above them and about them, but now and again a dull red light flickered up under the lowering clouds, and for a moment they were aware of tall peaks in front and on either side, like pillars holding up a vast, sagging roof. they seemed to have climbed up many hundreds of feet, onto a wide shelf. A cliff was on their left, and a chasm on their right. Gollum led the way close under the cliff. For the present they were no longer climbing, but the ground was now more broken and dangerous in the dark, and there were blocks and lumps of fallen stone in the way. Their going was slow and cautious. How many hours had passed since they had entered the Morgul Vale, neither Sam nor Frodo could any longer guess. The night seemed endless. At length they were once more aware of a wall looming up, and once more a stairway opened before them. Again they halted, and again they began to climb. It was a long and weary ascent, but this stairway did not delve into the mountainside. Here the huge cliff face sloped backwards, and the path, like a snake, wound to and fro across it. At one point it crawled sideways, right to the edge of the dark chasm, and Frodo, glancing down, saw below him, as a vast deep pit, the great ravine at the head of the Morgul Valley. Down in its depths glimmered like a glow-worm thread the wraith road from the dead city to the Nameless Pass. He turned hastily away. Still on and up the stairway bent and crawled, until at last, with a final flight, short and straight, it climbed out again onto another level. The path had veered away from the main pass in the great ravine, and it now followed its own perilous course at the bottom of a lesser cleft among the higher regions of the Ef-el-Duath. Dimly the hobbits could discern tall piers and jagged pinnacles of stone on either side, between which were great crevices and fissures blacker than the night, where forgotten winters had gnawed and carved the sunless stone. And now the red light in the sky seemed stronger, though they could not tell whether a dreadful morning were indeed coming to this place of shadow, or whether they saw only the flame of some great violence of Sauron in the torment of Gorgoroth beyond. Still far ahead, and still high above, Frodo, looking up, saw, as he guessed, the very crown of this bitter road. Against the sullen redness of the eastern sky, a cleft was outlined in the topmost ridge, narrow, deep cloven between two black shoulders, and on either shoulder was a horn of stone. He paused and looked more attentively. The horn upon the left was tall and slender, and in it burned a red light, or else the red light in the land beyond was shining through a hole. He saw now. It was a black tower poised above the outer pass. He touched Sam's arm and pointed.
"I don't like the look of that," said Sam. "So this secret way of yours is guarded after all," he growled, turning to Gollum. "As you knew all along, I suppose."
"Always are watched, yes," said Gollum. "Of course they are. But hobbits must try some way. This may be least watched. Perhaps they've all gone away to big battle, perhaps."
"Perhaps," grunted Sam. "Well, it seems a long way off, and a long way up before we get there, and there's still the tunnel. I think you ought to rest now, Mr. Frodo. I don't know what time of day or night it is, but we've kept going for hours and hours."
"Yes, we must rest," said Frodo. "Let us find some corner out of the wind and gather our strength for the last lap." For so he felt it to be. The terrors of the land beyond, and the deed to be done there, seemed remote, too far off yet to trouble him. All his mind was bent on getting through or over this impenetrable wall and guard. If once he could do that impossible thing, then somehow the errand would be accomplished, or so it seemed to him, in that dark hour of weariness, still labouring in the stony shadows above Cidith Ungol. In a dark crevice between two great piers of rock they sat down, Frodo and Sam a little way within, and Gollum crouched upon the ground near the opening. There the hobbits took what they expected would be their last meal before they went down into the Nameless Land, maybe the last meal they would ever eat together. Some of the food of Gondor they ate, and wafers of the waybread of the elves, and they drank a little. But of their water they were sparing, and took only enough to moisten their dry mouths.
"I wonder when we'll find water again," said Sam.
But I suppose even over there they drink. Orcs drink, don't they?
Yes, they drink, said Frodo. But don't let us speak of that. Such drink is not for us.
Then all the more need to fill our bottles, said Sam.
But there isn't any water up here. Not a sound or a trickle have I heard. And anyway, Faramir said we were not to drink any water in Morgul.
No water flowing out of Imlad Morgul, were his words, said Frodo. We are not in that valley now, and if we came out on a spring it would be flowing into it and not out of it.
I wouldn't trust it, said Sam, not till I was dying of thirst. There's a wicked feeling about this place, he sniffed, and a smell, I fancy.
Do you notice it? A queer kind of smell, stuffy. I don't like it.
I don't like anything here at all, said Frodo. Step or stone, breath or bone, earth, air and water all seem accursed. But so our path is laid.
Yes, that's so, said Sam. And we shouldn't be here at all, if we'd known more about it before we started. But I suppose it's often that way. The brave things and the old tales and songs, Mr. Frodo. Adventurers, as I used to call them. I used to think that they were things the wonderful folk of the stories went out and looked for, because they wanted them, because they were exciting and life was a bit dull, a kind of sport, as you might say. But that's not the way of it with the tales that really mattered, or the ones that stay in the mind. Folk seem to have been just landed in them, usually. Their paths were laid that way, as you put it. But I expect they had lots of chances, like us, of turning back. Only they didn't. And if they had, we shouldn't know, because they'd have been forgotten. We hear about those as just went on, and not all to a good end, mind you. At least not to what folk inside a story, and not outside it, call a good end. You know, coming home and finding things all right, though not quite the same, like old Mr. Bilbo. But those aren't always the best tales to hear, though they may be the best tales to get landed in. I wonder what sort of a tale we've fallen into.
I wonder, said Frodo, but I don't know. And that's the way of a real tale.
Take anyone that you're fond of. You may know or guess what kind of a tale it is, happy ending or sad ending, but the people in it don't know. And you don't want them to.
No, sir, of course not.
Baron now. He never thought he was going to get that Silmaril from the Iron Crown in Thangorodrim, and yet he did, and that was a worse place and a blacker danger than ours. But that's a long tale, of course, and goes on past the happiness and into grief and beyond it. And the Silmaril went on and came to Iarendil. And why, sir, I never thought of that before. We've got, you've got, some of the light of it, in that star-glass that the lady gave you. Why, to think of it, we're in the same tale still. It's going on. Don't the great tales never end?
No, they never end as tales, said Frodo. But the people in them come and go when their part's ended. Our part will end later, or sooner.
And then we can have some rest and some sleep, said Sam. He laughed grimly. And I mean just that, Mr. Frodo. I mean plain ordinary rest and sleep, and waking up to a morning's work in the garden. I'm afraid that's all I'm hoping for all the time. All the big important plans are not for my sort.
Still,
I wonder if we shall ever be put into songs or tales. We're in one, of course. But I mean, put into words, you know, told by the fireside, or read out of a great big book with red and black letters, years and years afterwards. And people will say, let's hear about Frodo and the Ring. And they'll say, yes, that's one of my favourite stories. Frodo was very brave, wasn't he, Dad?
Yes, my boy, the famousest of the hobbits, and that's saying a lot.
It's saying a lot too much, said Frodo, and he laughed, a long, clear laugh from his heart. Such a sound had not been heard in those places since Sauron came to Middle-earth. To Sam, suddenly, it seemed as if all the stones were listening and the tall rocks leaning over them. But Frodo did not heed them. He laughed again.
Why, Sam, he said,
To hear you somehow makes me as merry as if the story was already written. But you've left out one of the chief characters, Samwise the Stout-hearted. I want to hear more about Sam, Dad. Why didn't they put in more of his talk, Dad? That's what I like. It makes me laugh. And Frodo wouldn't have got far without Sam, would he, Dad?
Now, Mr. Frodo, said Sam, you shouldn't make fun. I was serious.
So was I, said Frodo, and so I am. We're going on a bit too fast. You and I, Sam, are still stuck in the worst places of the story. And it is all too likely that some will say at this point,
Shut the book now, Dad. We don't want to read any more.
Maybe, said Sam, but I wouldn't be one to say that. Things done and over and made into part of the great tales are different. Why, even Gollum might be good in a tale. Better than he is to have by you anyway. And he used to like tales himself once, by his own account. I wonder if he thinks he's the hero or the villain.
Gollum, he called. Would you like to be the hero? Now where has he got to again?
There was no sign of him at the mouth of their shelter, nor in the shadows near. He had refused their food, though he had, as usual, accepted a mouthful of water, and then he had seemed to curl up for a sleep. They'd supposed that one, at any rate, of his objects in his long absence the day before, had been to hunt for food to his own liking, and now he had evidently slipped off again while they talked. But what for this time?
I don't like his sneaking off without saying, said Sam. And least of all now. He can't be looking for food up here, not unless there's some kind of rock he fancies. Why, there isn't even a bit of moss.
It's no good worrying about him now, said Frodo. We couldn't have got so far, not even within sight of the pass, without him, and so we'll have to put up with his ways. If his faults is faults.
All the same, I'd rather have him under my eye, said Sam. All the more so, if his faults. Do you remember he never would say if this pass was guarded or no? And now we see a tower there, and it may be deserted, and it may not. Do you think he's gone to fetch them orcs, or whatever they are?
No, I don't think so, answered Frodo. Even if he's up to some wickedness, and I suppose that's not unlikely, I don't think it's that. Not to fetch orcs, or any servant of the enemy.
Why wait till now, and go through all the labour of the climb, and come so near the land he fears?
He could probably have betrayed us to orcs many times since we met him.
No, if it's anything, it will be some little private trick of his own that he thinks is quite secret.
Well, I suppose you're right, Mr. Frodo, said Sam.
Not that it comforts me mightily.
I don't make no mistake. I don't doubt he'd hand me over to orcs as gladly as kiss his hand. But I was forgetting. He's precious. No, I suppose the whole time it's been the precious for poor Smeagol. That's the one idea in all his little schemes, if he has any. But our bringing us up here will help him in that, is more than I can guess.
Very likely he can't guess himself, said Frodo. And I don't think he's got just one plain scheme in his muddled head. I think he really is, in part, trying to save the precious from the enemy as long as he can. For that would be the last disaster for himself, too, if the enemy got it. And in the other part, perhaps, he's just biding his time and waiting on chance.
Yes, slinker and stinker, as I've said before, said Sam. But the nearer they get to the enemy's land, the more like Stinker Slinker will get. Mark my words, if ever we get to the pass, he won't let us really take the precious thing over the border without making some kind of trouble.
We haven't got there yet, said Frodo.
No, but we'd better keep our eyes skinned till we do.
If we're caught napping, Stinker will come out on top pretty quick.
Not but what it would be safe for us to have a wink now, master. Safe, if you lay close to me.
I'd be dearly glad to see you have a sleep. I'd keep watch over you, and anyway, if you lay near, with my arm round you, no one could come pawing you without your Sam knowing it.
Sleep, said Frodo, and sighed, as if out of a desert he had seen a mirage of cool green. Yes, even here I could sleep. Sleep then, master. Lay your head in my lap. And so Gollum found them hours later, when he returned, crawling and creeping down the path out of the gloom ahead. Sam sat propped against the stone, his head dropping sideways and his breathing heavy. In his lap lay Frodo's head, drowned deep in sleep. Upon his white forehead lay one of Sam's brown hands, and the other lay softly upon his master's breast. Peace was in both their faces. Gollum looked at them. A strange expression passed over his lean, hungry face. The gleam faded from his eyes, and they went dim and grey, old and tired. A spasm of pain seemed to twist him, and he turned away, peering back up towards the pass, shaking his head as if engaged in some interior debate. Then he came back, and slowly putting out a trembling hand, very cautiously he touched Frodo's knee, but almost the touch was a caress. For a fleeting moment, could one of the sleepers have seen it, they would have thought that they beheld an old, weary hobbit, shrunken by the years that had carried him far beyond his time, beyond friends and kin, and the fields and streams of youth, an old, starved, pitiable thing. But at that touch, Frodo stirred and cried out softly in his sleep, and immediately Sam was wide awake. The first thing he saw was Gollum, pawing at master, as he thought. "Hey, you," he said roughly, "what are you up to?"
"Nothing, nothing," said Gollum softly. "Nice, master."
"I dare say," said Sam. "But where have you been to? Sneaking off and sneaking back, you old villain." Gollum withdrew himself, and a green glint flickered under his heavy lids. Almost spider-like he looked now, crouched back on his bent limbs, with his protruding eyes. The fleeting moment had passed beyond recall.
"Sneaking, sneaking," he hissed. "Hobbits always so polite, yes. Oh, nice, hobbits. Smeagol brings them up secret ways that nobody else could find. Tired he is, thirsty he is, yes, thirsty. And he guides them, and he searches for paths, and they say, 'Sneak, sneak.' Very nice friends. Oh, yes, my precious, very nice."
Sam felt a bit remorseful, though not more trustful. "Sorry," he said. "I'm sorry, but you startled me out of my sleep. And I shouldn't have been sleeping, and that made me a bit sharp. But Mr. Frodo, he's that tired. I asked him to have a wink, and, well, that's how it is. Sorry. But where have you been to?"
"Sneaking," said Gollum,
and the green glint did not leave his eyes.
"Oh, very well," said Sam. "Have it your own way. I don't suppose it's so far from the truth. And now we'd better all be sneaking along together. What's the time? Is it today or tomorrow?" "It's tomorrow," said Gollum. "Or this was tomorrow when hobbits went to sleep. Very foolish, very dangerous. If poor Smeagol wasn't sneaking about to watch."
"I think we shall get tired of that word soon," said Sam. "But never mind. I'll wake master up." Gently he smoothed the hair back from Frodo's brow, and bending down, spoke softly to him. "Wake up, Mr. Frodo. Wake up." Frodo stirred and opened his eyes and smiled, seeing Sam's face bending over him.
"Calling me early, aren't you, Sam?" he said. "It's dark still."
"Yes, it's always dark here," said Sam. "But Gollum's come back, Mr. Frodo, and he says it's tomorrow, so we must be walking on, the last lap." Frodo drew a deep breath and sat up.
"The last lap," he said.
"Hello, Smeagol. Found any food? Have you had any rest?"
"No food, no rest, nothing for Smeagol," said Gollum. "He's a sneak."
Sam clicked his tongue, but restrained himself. "Don't take names to yourself, Smeagol," said Frodo. "It's unwise, whether they are true or false."
"Smeagol has to take what's given him," answered Gollum. "He was given that name by kind master Samwise, the hobbit that knows so much."
Frodo looked at Sam.
"Yes, sir," he said. "I did use the word, waking up out of my sleep sudden and all, and finding him at hand. I said I was sorry, but I soon shan't be."
"Come, let it pass, then," said Frodo. "But now we seem to have come to the point, you and I, Smeagol. Tell me, can we find the rest of the way by ourselves? We're in sight of the pass, of a way in, and if we can find it now, then I suppose our agreement can be said to be over. You've done what you promised, and you're free. Free to go back to food and rest, wherever you wish to go, except to servants of the enemy. And one day I may reward you, I or those that remember me."
"No, no, not yet," Gollum whined. "Oh, no, they can't find the way themselves, can they? Oh, no, indeed. There's the tunnel coming. Smeagol must go on. No rest, no food, not yet."
Chapter 9. Shelob's Lair. It may indeed have been daytime now, as Gollum said, but the hobbits could see little difference, unless, perhaps, the heavy sky above was less utterly black, more like a great roof of smoke, while instead of the darkness of deep night, which lingered still in cracks and holes, a grey blurring shadow shrouded the stony world about them. They passed on, Gollum in front and the hobbits now side by side, up the long ravine between the piers and columns of torn and weathered rock, standing like huge unshapen statues on either hand. There was no sound. Somewhere ahead, a mile or so, perhaps, was a great grey wall, a last huge upthrusting mass of mountain stone. Darker it loomed, and steadily it rose as they approached, until it towered up high above them, shutting out the view of all that lay beyond. Deep shadow lay before its feet. Sam sniffed the air. "Huh, that smell," he said. "It's getting stronger and stronger." Presently they were under the shadow, and there in the midst of it they saw the opening of a cave.
"This is the way in," said Gollum softly. "This is the entrance to the tunnel."
He did not speak its name. Torech Ungol, Shelob's Lair. Out of it came a stench, not the sickly odour of decay in the meads of Morgul, but a foul reek, as if filth unnameable were piled and hoarded in the dark within. "Is this the only way, Smeagol?" said Frodo.
"Yes, yes," he answered. "Yes, we must go this way now."
"Do you mean to say you've been through this hole?" said Sam. "Phew! But perhaps you don't mind bad smells."
Gollum's eyes glinted.
"He doesn't know what we minds, does he, precious? No, he doesn't. But Smeagol can bear things. Yes, he's been through. Oh, yes, right through. It's the only way."
"And what makes the smell, I wonder?" said Sam. "It's like, well, I wouldn't like to say. Some beastly hole of the orcs, I'll warrant, with 100 years of their filth in it."
"Well," said Frodo, "orcs or no, if it's the only way, we must take it."
Drawing a deep breath, they passed inside. In a few steps they were in utter and impenetrable dark. Not since the lightless passages of Moria had Frodo or Sam known such darkness, and if possible, here it was deeper and denser. There were airs moving, and echoes, and a sense of space. Here the air was still, stagnant, heavy, and sound fell dead. They walked, as it were, in a black vapour wrought of veritable darkness itself that, as it was breathed, brought blindness not only to the eyes but to the mind, so that even the memory of colours and of forms and of any light faded out of thought. Night always had been, and always would be, and night was all. But for a while they could still feel, and indeed the senses of their feet and fingers at first seemed sharpened almost painfully. The walls felt, to their surprise, smooth, and the floor, save for a step now and again, was straight and even, going ever up at the same stiff slope.
The tunnel was high and wide, so wide that, though the hobbits walked abreast, only touching the side walls with their outstretched hands, they were separated, cut off alone in the darkness. Gollum had gone in first, and seemed to be only a few steps ahead. While they were still able to give heed to such things, they could hear his breath hissing and gasping just in front of them. But after a time their senses became duller. Both touch and hearing seemed to grow numb, and they kept on, groping, walking, on and on, mainly by the force of the will with which they had entered, will to go through and desire to come at last to the high gate beyond. Before they had gone very far, perhaps, but time and distance soon passed out of his reckoning. Sam, on the right, feeling the wall, was aware that there was an opening at the side. For a moment he caught a faint breath of some air less heavy, and then they passed it. "There's more than one passage here," he whispered with an effort. It seemed hard to make his breath give any sound. "It's as orc-like a place as ever there could be." After that, first he on the right, and then Frodo on the left, passed three or four such openings, some wider, some smaller, but there was as yet no doubt of the main way, for it was straight, and did not turn, and still went steadily up. But how long was it? How much more of this would they have to endure, or could they endure? The breathlessness of the air was growing as they climbed, and now they seemed often in the blind dark to sense some resistance thicker than the foul air. As they thrust forward, they felt things brush against their heads, or against their hands, long tentacles, or hanging growths, perhaps. They could not tell what they were, and still the stench grew. It grew, until almost it seemed to them that smell was the only clear sense left to them, and that was for their torment. 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, how many had they passed in this lightless hole? Hours, days, weeks, rather. Sam left the tunnel side and shrank towards Frodo, and their hands met and clasped, and so together they still went on. At length Frodo, groping along the left-hand wall, came suddenly to a void. Almost he fell sideways into the emptiness. Here was some opening in the rock, far wider than any they had yet passed, and out of it came a reek so foul, and a sense of lurking malice so intense, that Frodo reeled, and at that moment Sam too lurched and fell forwards. Fighting off both the sickness and the fear, Frodo gripped Sam's hand. "Ugh!" he said in a hoarse breath without voice. "It all comes from here, the stench and the peril. Now for it, quick!" Calling up his remaining strength and resolution, he dragged Sam to his feet and forced his own limbs to move. Sam stumbled beside him. One step, two steps, three steps, at last six steps. Maybe they had passed the dreadful unseen opening, but whether that was so or not, suddenly it was easier to move, as if some hostile will for the moment had released them. They struggled on, still hand in hand. But almost at once they came to a new difficulty. The tunnel forked, or so it seemed, and in the dark they could not tell which was the wider way, or which kept nearer to the straight. Which should they take, the left or the right? They knew of nothing to guide them, yet a false choice would almost certainly be fatal. "Which way is Gollum gone?" panted Sam. "And why didn't he wait?" "Smeagol!" said Frodo, trying to call. "Smeagol!" But his voice croaked, and the name fell dead almost as it left his lips. There was no answer, not an echo, not even a tremor of the air. "He's really gone this time, I fancy," muttered Sam. "I guess this is just exactly where he meant to bring us. Gollum, if ever I lay hands on you again, you'll be sorry for it." Presently, groping and fumbling in the dark, they found that the opening on the left was blocked. Either it was a blind, or else some great stone had fallen in the passage. "This can't be the way," Frodo whispered. "Right or wrong, we must take the other."
"And quick!" Sam panted. "There's something worse than Gollum about. I can feel something looking at us."
They had not gone more than a few yards when from behind them came a sound, startling and horrible in the heavy padded silence, a gurgling, bubbling noise, and a long, venomous hiss. They wheeled round, but nothing could be seen. Still as stones they stood, staring, waiting for they did not know what.
"It's a trap," said Sam,
and he laid his hold upon the hilt of his sword, and as he did so, he thought of the darkness of the barrow whence it came. "I wish old Tom was near us now," he thought. Then, as he stood, darkness about him, and a blackness of despair and anger in his heart, it seemed to him that he saw a light in his mind, almost unbearably bright at first, as a sun-ray to the eyes of one long hidden in a windowless pit. Then the light became colour, green, gold, silver, white, far off, as in a little picture drawn by elven fingers. He saw the Lady Galadriel standing on the grass in Lorien, and gifts were in her hands. "And you, Ring-bearer," he heard her say, remote but clear, "for you I have prepared this." The bubbling hiss drew nearer, and there was a creaking as of some great jointed thing that moved with slow purpose in the dark. A reek came on before it.
"Master! Master!" cried Sam,
and the life and urgency came back into his voice.
"The lady's gift, the star-glass. A light to you in dark places, she said it was to be, the star-glass."
"The star-glass?" muttered Frodo, as one answering out of sleep, hardly comprehending. "Why, yes. Why had I forgotten it? A light when all other lights go out. And now, indeed, light alone can help us." Slowly his hand went to his bosom, and slowly he held aloft the phial of Galadriel. For a moment it glimmered, faint as a rising star struggling in heavy earthward mists. And then as its power waxed, and hope grew in Frodo's mind, it began to burn, and kindled to a silver flame, a minute heart of dazzling light, as though Earendil had himself come down from the high sunset paths with the last Silmaril upon his brow. The darkness receded from it until it seemed to shine in the centre of a globe of airy crystal, and the hand that held it sparkled with white fire. Frodo gazed in wonder at this marvellous gift that he had so long carried, not guessing its full worth and potency. Seldom had he remembered it on the road, until they came to Morgul Vale, and never had he used it for fear of its revealing light. "Aia Earendil Eleniol an Kalima," he cried, and knew not what he had spoken. For it seemed that another voice spoke through his, clear, untroubled by the foul air of the pit. But other potencies there are in Middle-earth, powers of night, and they are old and strong. And she that walked in the darkness had heard the elves cry that cry far back in the deeps of time, and she had not heeded it, and it did not daunt her now. Even as Frodo spoke, he felt a great malice bent upon him, and a deadly regard considering him. Not far down the tunnel, between them and the opening where they had reeled and stumbled, he was aware of eyes growing visible, two great clusters of many-windowed eyes. The coming menace was unmasked at last. The radiance of the star-glass was broken and thrown back from their thousand facets, but behind the glitter a pale deadly fire began steadily to glow within, a flame kindled in some deep pit of evil thought. Monstrous and abominable eyes they were, bestial and yet filled with purpose and with hideous delight, gloating over their prey trapped beyond all hope of escape. Frodo and Sam, horror-stricken, began slowly to back away, their own gaze held by the dreadful stare of those baleful eyes. But as they backed, so the eyes advanced. Frodo's hand wavered, and slowly the phial drooped. Then suddenly,
released from the holding spell, to run a little while in vain panic for the amusement of the eyes, they both turned and fled together. But even as they ran, Frodo looked back and saw with terror that at once the eyes came leaping up behind. The stench of death was like a cloud about him. "Stand! Stand!" he cried desperately. "Running is no use." Slowly the eyes crept nearer. "Galadriel!" he called, and gathering his courage, he lifted up the phial once more. The eyes halted. For a moment their guard relaxed, as if some hint of doubt troubled them. Then Frodo's heart flamed within him, and without thinking what he did, whether it was folly or despair or courage, he took the phial in his left hand, and with his right hand drew his sword. Sting flashed out, and the sharp elven blade sparkled in the silver light, but at its edges a blue fire flicked. Then, holding the star aloft and the bright sword advanced, Frodo, Hobbit of the Shire, walked steadily down to meet the eyes. They wavered. Doubt came into them as the light approached. One by one they dimmed, and slowly they drew back. No brightness so deadly had ever afflicted them before. From sun and moon and star they had been safe underground, but now a star had descended into the very earth. Still it approached, and the eyes began to quail. One by one they all went dark. They turned away, and a great bulk, beyond the light's reach, heaved its huge shadow in between. They were gone. "Master! Master!" cried Sam. He was close behind, his own sword drawn and ready. "Stars and glory! But the elves would make a song of that, if ever they heard of it. And may I live to tell them and hear them sing. But don't go on, Master. Don't go down to that den. Now's our only chance. Now let's get out of this foul hole." And so back they turned once more, first walking and then running, for as they went the floor of the tunnel rose steeply, and with every stride they clambered higher above the stenches of the unseen lair, and strength returned to limb and heart. But still the hatred of the Watcher lurked behind them, blind for a while, perhaps, but undefeated, still bent on death. And now there came a flow of air to meet them, cold and thin. The opening, the tunnel's end, at last it was before them. Panting, yearning for a roofless place, they flung themselves forward, and then in amazement they staggered, tumbling back. The outlet was blocked with some barrier, but not of stone, soft and a little yielding, it seemed, and yet strong and impervious. Air filtered through, but not a glimmer of any light. Once more they charged and were hurled back. Holding aloft the phial, Frodo looked, and before him he saw a greyness which the radiance of the star-glass did not pierce and did not illuminate, as if it were a shadow that, being cast by no light, no light could dissipate. Across the width and height of the tunnel a vast web was spun, orderly as the web of some huge spider, but denser woven and far greater, and each thread was as thick as rope. Sam laughed grimly.
"Cobwebs," he said. "Is that all? Cobwebs? But what a spider! Have at 'em! Down with 'em!"
In a fury he hewed at them with his sword, but the thread that he struck did not break. It gave a little, and then sprang back like a plucked bowstring, turning the blade and tossing up both sword and arm. Three times Sam struck with all his force, and at last one single cord of all the countless cords snapped and twisted, curling and whipping through the air. One end of it lashed Sam's hand, and he cried out in pain, starting back and drawing his hand across his mouth.
"It'll take days to clear the road like this," he said. "What's to be done? Have those eyes come back?"
"No, not to be seen," said Frodo, "but I still feel that they're looking at me, or thinking about me, making some other plan, perhaps. If this light were lowered, if it failed, they would quickly come again."
"Trapped in the end," said Sam bitterly,
his anger rising again above weirdness and despair. "Gnats in a net. May the curse of Faramir bite that Gollum, and bite him quick.
"That would not help us now," said Frodo. "Come, let's see what Sting can do. It is an elven blade. There were webs of horror in the dark ravines of Beleriand, where it was forged. But you must be the guard and hold back the eyes. Here, take the star glass. Don't be afraid. Hold it up and watch." Then Frodo stepped up to the great grey net and hewed it with a wide sweeping stroke, drawing the bitter edge swiftly across a ladder of close-strung cords and at once springing away. The blue gleaming blade shore through them like a scythe through grass, and they leapt and writhed and then hung loose. A great rent was made. Stroke after stroke he dealt, until at last all the web within his reach was shattered, and the upper portion blew and swayed like a loose veil in the incoming wind. The trap was broken.
"Come!" cried Frodo. "On! On!"
Wild joy at their escape from the very mouth of despair suddenly filled all his mind. His head whirled as with a draught of potent wine. He sprang out, shouting as he came. It seemed light in that dark land to his eyes that had passed through the den of night. The great smokes had risen and grown thinner, and the last hours of a sombre day were passing. The red glare of Mordor had died away in sullen gloom. Yet it seemed to Frodo that he looked upon a morning of sudden hope. Almost he had reached the summit of the wall. Only a little higher now, the cleft, Cirith Ungol, was before him, a dim notch in the black ridge, and the horns of rock darkling in the sky on either side. A short race, a sprinter's course, and he would be through.
"The pass, Sam!"
he cried, not heeding the shrillness of his voice, that, released from the choking airs of the tunnel, rang out now high and wild.
"The pass! Run, run, and we'll be through! Through before anyone can stop us!"
Sam came up behind as fast as he could urge his legs, but glad as he was to be free, he was uneasy, and as he ran, he kept on glancing back at the dark arch of the tunnel, fearing to see eyes, or some shape beyond his imagining, spring out in pursuit. Too little did he or his master know of the craft of Shelob. She had many exits from her lair. There age-long she had dwelt, an evil thing in spider form, even such as once of old had lived in the land of the elves in the west that is now under the sea, such as Beren fought in the mountains of Terror in Doriath, and so came to Lúthien upon the green sward amid the hemlocks in the moonlight long ago. How Shelob came there, flying from ruin, no tale tells, for out of the dark years few tales have come. But still she was there. Who was there before Sauron, and before the first stone of Barad-dûr? And she served none but herself, drinking the blood of elves and men, bloated and grown fat with endless brooding on her feasts, weaving webs of shadow. For all living things were her food, and her vomit darkness. Far and wide her lesser broods, bastards of the miserable mates, her own offspring that she slew, spread from glen to glen, from the Efelduath to the eastern hills, to Dol Guldur and the fastnesses of Mirkwood. But none could rival her, Shelob the Great, last child of Ungoliant to trouble the unhappy world. Already, years before, Gollum had beheld her, Smeagol, who pried into all dark holes, and in past days he had bowed and worshipped her, and the darkness of her evil will walked through all the ways of his weariness beside him, cutting him off from light and from regret. And he had promised to bring her food. But her lust was not his lust. Little she knew of, or cared, for towers, or rings, or anything devised by mind or hand, who only desired death for all others, mind and body, and for herself a glut of life. Alone, swollen till the mountains could no longer hold her up, and the darkness could not contain her. But that desire was yet far away, and long now had she been hungry, lurking in her den, while the power of Sauron grew, and light and living things forsook his borders,
and the city in the valley was dead, and no elf or man came near, only the unhappy orcs. Poor food and weary, but she must eat, and however busily they delved new winding passages from the